I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. When we booked this interview a few days ago, we wanted to focus on events in the United States that have raised questions and concerns about racial profiling, how blacks and whites often have different perceptions about events, for instance, what took place in Ferguson, Missouri this past summer. We still want to explore the roots of our unconscious beliefs and biases about other racial and ethnic groups, how they can lead to racism and hate crimes, and how they can be changed. We also want to acknowledge what happened in France yesterday, the terror attack in Paris on the satirical newspaper Charlie Hebdo, and the murder of 12 people has shocked most of the world. Many took to the streets holding signs that said, "Je suis Charlie," or "I am Charlie." Like the United States, there are racial tensions in France involving the native-born and immigrants from the Middle East and Africa. That makes our discussion of stereotyping and conscious and unconscious bias even more important and even more relevant. And let me introduce our two guests. Joining us here in our Philadelphia studio is Stacey Sinclair. She's Associate Professor of Psychology and African American Studies at Princeton University. And Stacey, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great. Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here.
Nice to have you here. And joining us by telephone is Jack Glazer. He's an associate professor and associate dean at the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley, author of a book called Suspect Race, Causes and Consequences of Racial Profiling. And Jack, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Stacey, let me begin with you. And I want to put a couple of questions to both you and Jack about what happened yesterday in Paris and perhaps even raising some of the concerns that you might have about the aftermath of this really horrendous terror attack. What are your concerns, Stacey?
Naturally, my empathy, I have a lot of empathy for the victims and for Parisians in general, but I worry about the potential for anti-Islamic hate crimes and discrimination. So after 9/11, there was a tremendous increase in the number of anti-Arab hate crimes. For example, in California, in the 6 months post 9/11, they increased by about 300% relative to prior to 9/11. And being exposed to that kind of stress and that kind of discrimination has significant consequences for target groups. So in California at that time, a researcher named Diane Lauderdale tracked the birth weights of women with Arab American names. And she found that women with Arab American names were 34% more likely to have low birth weight children 6 months after 9/11 than another time. And this was specific to Arab American women, so other ethnicities didn't have this experience.
What are your concerns, Jack?
Similar. Stacey points out some really important effects there. And I would add that in the hate crime statistics following 9/11 in the U.S., in addition to anti-Muslim hate crimes, there was a big spike in hate crimes against other ethnic groups that are not identifiable. So these are not identifiable in the FBI statistics. And these are people from groups like Sikhs and others who are commonly mistaken for Muslims. And the jump was about the same as it was for Muslims. And for both groups, the rate of hate crimes came down over the subsequent years, but never got back down to the pre-9/11 rates that we had seen. So these can have lasting effects, and I think in France, it's very likely we're going to see anti-Muslim attitudes and hate crimes potentially. And so the collateral target group is going to end up being Muslims in France and other countries in Europe.
Jack, do you see, and I know that you have studied hate groups, but do you see terrorists as hate groups? Can we use that interchangeably?
No, I wouldn't use it interchangeably, and I think it's useful to make distinctions. Hate crimes in particular are those that are motivated by bias against the groups to which the victims belong, and they need not be strategic in the sense that terrorist acts tend to be. And terrorist acts are motivated by a desire to change the behavior or attitudes of the groups to which the targets belong. So they're much more strategic. They're less, believe it or not, they're less emotional. Terrorists are often perceived as psychopaths, but they're not. They're typically psychologically relatively normal. And hate crime perpetrators can be psychologically normal as well, but they they tend to commit their hate crimes in a moment where they are where they're motivated by strong emotions, and that you combine that with their prejudicial attitudes, and you get the hate crime. But terrorism is usually much more premeditated and strategic.
You both agree that you share concern that there could be some kind of revenge, I guess, on Muslims in France. But I wondered to you, Stacey, then, mm-hmm. and what you think government leaders or religious leaders, others, can do to prevent that, or at least to address that potential threat.
I think the most important thing is to advocate for calm. So Jack had mentioned the hate crimes, which are a particular concern. They occur in moments of strong emotion, of animus. And so to the extent you can get people to just calm down, they may be less likely to strike out in this way.
To you, Jack, and what's, this is sort of a tricky thing to put, but I'll say it anyway, which is when you look at the kind of terrorism, it seems to be associated these days with Islam. On the other hand, as we know, most Muslims are not terrorists, and yet that thinking can lead to discrimination, can lead to things like religious profiling.
Right. Yeah, and that's we generally have this phenomenon of stereotyping where a whole group of people will be painted with the same brush as a small number, whether or not they actually behave in the manner that is consistent with the stereotype. And with the case of terrorism, it's such a potent and salient experience that it can have a relatively instantaneous and powerful effect on shaping stereotypes and shaping behaviors. People are understandably upset. But it's important to remember that, there are about 65 million people in France, and 10% of them are Muslims. So that gives us about 6.5 million Muslims in France. And to our knowledge, there were 3 perpetrators at this event. And so we have to keep the denominator in mind that, the vast majority of Muslims in France are peaceful people. And that would be something that would be a valuable thing to come out of the mouths of the leaders in France, a reminder. And I have to give credit to President Bush. After 9/11, he was giving messages along those lines, and I think they were helpful. Although, even in spite of those, we saw that major spike in hate crimes.
As I said, we put the show together a couple of days ago before all this happened in Paris, and we wanted to at least acknowledge what is happening in France and some of the questions that it raised. But I do want to sort of get back to, I guess, the original plans for the show, if I could. And I'll put this to you, Stacey. Is prejudice, we're not, as babies, we don't have prejudices. Is prejudice a learned belief?
That's an interesting question, actually. So there are indirect ways of measuring prejudice. And people, a researcher in particular named Yarrow Dunham, has shown that children as young as, 4 years old show, with these indirect measures, pro-white, anti-black bias. So I think the conventional understanding is that it's something we learn through exposure, through the media, through other environmental cues associating blacks, for example, with poverty or crime. But there's new, I think, emerging thinking that to some extent we may be predisposed to be wary of out-group members.
Sort of hardwired in a way?
I would be hesitant to say that now, but I think some people are interested in trying to make that kind of argument.
How do you see prejudice, Jack?
Similarly, and I'll say what we are hardwired to do is to categorize objects and people into discrete classifications. And so at a very young age, children start to notice gender categories and then racial and ethnic categories. And setting aside the question of whether race is a social construct or a biological construct or whatever, it's an observable thing that people see. And children start seeing it at an early age. And then there are good reasons to predict that they would, and research that indicates that people show a strong preference for things that are similar to themselves and familiar to them. And so those are sort of the roots of, beginnings of prejudice and bias. And then we layer on top of that all the information that we receive about what people who fit a particular category are like, and those are the stereotypes. And we learn those fairly readily. We are also hardwired to connect information and attributes in our minds with those categories. So whether or not we're hardwired to be prejudiced is one thing or another, but we are hardwired to do all of these, to have all of these antecedent types of cognitions that lead to prejudice or that support prejudice. So it's fairly, I mean, one thing to just point out here is that that's all normal. That's normal human psychology. That's not psychopathology. And what we've done as a society is to largely transcend a lot of that and to say, well, we reject the notion that, you know, that we can pigeonhole people into having different stereotypes and traits. And nevertheless, we have to work against these strong mental tendencies that we have.
Is it hard, Stacey, to test for prejudice? I did take the Harvard test yesterday. But is it to come up with a test to sort of understand perhaps people's unconscious biases? Because those are the ones that even we might not be aware of about ourselves.
Right. So social psychologists, the kind of psychologist that I am, make a distinction between implicit and explicit prejudice. So the thinking is that explicit prejudice is the kind of prejudice we know that we have, we can express to other people, we can write down on a questionnaire.
We know this about ourselves, right?
Exactly. Whereas implicit prejudice is thought to be less open to conscious awareness and has to be tapped indirectly. And so the way researchers do that is with a variety of reaction time computer-based measures. So to give you an example,
sure.
We use a measure in our lab that's simpler than the one that you took. Participants come, they're looking at a computer. They see sunflowers flashing on a screen. After a sunflower flashes, they see either the word good or the word bad. And all they have to do is tap one button if they see the word good, tap another button if they see the word bad. What they don't realize is embedded within those sunflowers are pictures of white or black faces. They're presented subliminally, so they're presented quickly enough that your mind can process them, but you don't know that you've seen them. And what we find is that when people are flashed with these African-American faces, they're faster to recognize the word bad and slower to recognize the word good, but the opposite when they're flashed with the white faces.
And they don't know that they are seeing these faces embedded in the sunflowers.
They have no idea they're seeing these faces. And we can take responses on tasks like these and use them to predict people's behaviors.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Stacey Sinclair, Associate Professor of Psychology and African-American Studies at Princeton University, joining us here in our Philadelphia studio. Jack Glazer joining us by telephone. He's Associate Professor, also Associate Dean at the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley. He's written a book called Suspect Race, Causes and Consequences of Racial Profiling. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. We're looking for answers to this question. Where do our unconscious beliefs and biases toward other racial and ethnic groups come from? How can they be changed? We're looking at the psychology of racism and stereotypes with two researchers to find out how these ideas do persist. Again, joined by Jack Glazer, joining us by telephone, from California, University of California, Berkeley, and Stacey Sinclair here with us in our Philadelphia studio, and she's teaches at Princeton University. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at @WHYY Radio Times. Jack, you have been studying racial profiling, and it's such a large topic, and it's beyond policing, it seems to me. It's sort of how we, in many ways, sort of navigate through the world. How should we understand why we racially profile?
Sure. Well, one thing I want to say is that I limit the definition of racial profiling to law enforcement, just because I think it helps us to keep the concept clear in our minds when we talk about it. And for the other kinds of things that sometimes people will refer to as racial profiling, I would just more generically call that stereotype-based discrimination. But the importance of racial profiling is that it is the effect of stereotypes about people, about groups, and in particular about racial and ethnic groups relating to crime-related traits like violence and aggression and honesty and trustworthiness. And those stereotypes cause police officers to treat certain groups with greater suspicion, which in turn causes them to be more likely to interfere with those people, to stop them, to frisk them, to question them, to have them sit on the curb, to use force against them, and then potentially to arrest them. And so really what racial profiling is it's a psychological phenomenon that has an impact on the most fundamental policy interaction in society, which is the interaction between law enforcers and citizens. And so it has fundamental, important impacts on how our lives proceed. And it is essentially, like I said, it's a psychological phenomenon, and so it's something that we should not be surprised to see police officers doing, because, as we mentioned earlier, it's fairly normal for people to lump individuals into categories based on what they look like and then make presumptions about how they're going to behave based on the category that they belong to. And that's stereotype-based judgment. And police officers are normal people with normal cognition, and so they're going to engage in that kind of normal behavior. The problem is that that's problematic in a lot of domains, education, admissions, employment, mortgage lending, all kinds of things where discrimination is obviously undesirable, and even in just simple interpersonal interactions. But in law enforcement, when police officers make a decision to interact with somebody, the consequences can be immediate and very dire. And that's the case in just simple, you know, stop and frisk situations, but it's obviously the case in these more lethal situations.
And does that also then feed the stereotype about minorities and crime, and that sort of feeds the stereotype that if you're African American or if you're Hispanic, from an outsider's perspective, then you're seen as more criminal?
Well, yeah. So profiling itself can have a self-fulfilling effect, in the sense that if police are targeting one group more and spending more time in those neighborhoods, or more time pulling over African American or Latino drivers on, you know, on some presumed drug corridor on the highway. Sorry, I'm in California.
It's okay.
Then the effect of that is going to just mathematically and necessarily be that they're going to be catching more offenders among those groups, and then they're going to be incarcerating more offenders, and more of those people are going to be going through the criminal justice system and getting criminal records, et cetera, which is going to have destabilizing effects on their lives, their families' lives, and their communities' lives. So in that sense, it can have this snowball effect. And in fact, with most racial profiling, which is typically targeted toward nonviolent crimes like drug possession, you have, we have every reason to believe that offending rates are very similar between whites and minorities, and yet the policing rates, stop rates, and the arrest rates and the conviction rates are much higher amongst the minorities. And I think a large part of that is due just purely to racial profiling, purely to the police using the heuristic of race in making a determination about who they should investigate.
Stacey, do you think we all racially profile in our own way?
I think we all racially profile in our own way, definitely. And so, as Jack had mentioned, this stereotype-based responding is a basic process. So we are all hardwired to categorize. And this stereotype-based tendency affects our police interactions, but also a variety of other domains. So, for example, there's interesting work in the domain of hiring. So if we look first at college students, so there are some interesting experiments where they have college students come in and evaluate various resumes. So if the resumes are clearly fantastic, there's no difference in terms of how the black versus white person's resume is evaluated. If the resumes are clearly terrible, again, there's no ethnic discrepancy. Mm. But in those ambiguous cases where the person is moderately qualified for the job, college students are about 70% more likely to recommend the white person over the black person. You know, this is with college students, but we can take it out into the real world. There are these interesting studies. They're called audit studies. And what they do is researchers will find individuals who are similar in terms of height and weight and attractiveness. They train them very carefully to behave similarly. They set them up with resumes that are basically identical. The primary difference is that they're white or they're black, and they have them go in and apply for jobs. DivaPager has done a particularly well-known version of this kind of audit study, and what she found was when she had a white or black person apply for various jobs, these people also had different backgrounds in terms of incarceration. So they either had never been convicted of anything, or they might have had a felony drug charge. They apply for jobs, and what you find is that when you look at job offers and or callbacks for a second interview, the African-American non-offender was as likely to get a job offer as a white person with a drug background.
With a criminal background.
With a criminal background.
Right.
Yes. And even when you just look at who the potential employers call back for the first interview, they were 30% more likely to call a white person back than a black person, irrespective of the person's criminal background.
I was also reading about I think it's also a very famous study about mailing out identical job resumes. One had the name Jamal, I think, on the cover.
Right.
The other, Brendan, which so people would assume that Jamal is African-American, Brendan is white. Mm-hmm. And Brendan got 56% more callbacks, the Brendan resume.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
That's the Bertrand and Mullinathan study.
Yeah.
I think they used more than just Jamal and Brendan. They had a bunch of different names so that we can have more confidence that it wasn't just those two names in particular.
Right.
So it's a variety of names. And also an interesting thing about that study is they manipulated the quality of the resume. So there were some people who were more qualified. They had more work experience. They had more honors. And actually, African-Americans got no benefit from having a higher quality versus a lower quality resume in terms of callback.
So, Jack, is this
another thing to note about these studies? They sent out thousands of resumes to real firms. So this is what we would describe as a study with high external validity. It really happened with real firms making real decisions, even though the resumes were not real.
But, Jack, would you call that an unconscious bias? Is that what's at work here? Or is there any way to know whether it was more conscious in that?
Right. We can't know from that study. But I think it's a reasonable presumption that most of it was non-conscious, that these personnel staff at these firms were not consciously or deliberately discriminating, but that they were interpreting the information that they got through the resumes and through the spectrum of race. And that's an important thing to bear in mind with how this works, is that we typically, when we're making a judgment about another person, whether it's an applicant for a job or a criminal suspect, we have very incomplete information, and it's typically a highly ambiguous, uncertain situation. And it's under those uncertain situations where the stereotypes are particularly influential. So even though it might sound like, oh, you've got a whole resume, and this personnel director got this person's resume and that one got the other one, and they're identical, so why wouldn't they just come to the same conclusion? Well, it turns out that a resume is quite incomplete, and they can only call back a certain proportion of people, and so they're going to try to fill in the gaps. And whether they know it or not, the race of the person is causing them to interpret different aspects of the resume in different ways and give credit here and not there. So it's a subtle phenomenon, but it has these cumulative effects. You can only imagine what the cumulative effects are for an African-American applying for a job or going through their whole life, where every time they try to get some kind of beneficial outcome, they've got a small incremental deficit going into the situation.
I mean, it's kind of like your sunflower experiments, Stacey, which is these sort of embedded faces, and people make, they don't know it, but they're making choices based on that.
Yes, they're making the choices based on that. And what's interesting too is that people are more likely to rely on these implicit biases or these immediate stereotypic impulses when they are not devoting a lot of mental energy. And so you hear all the time that the average employer looks at your resume for a minute or two. So to the extent they're not devoting a lot of mental energy to even perusing the limited amount of information that's there, they're again going to be more likely to be influenced by stereotypes or prejudices when they're making these kinds of judgments.
So how do you change a stereotype? I mean, these are often deeply embedded feelings of people or beliefs that people have about other people. How do you change that?
They're very difficult to change. I think we have a long way to go with respect to the research on how to effectively reduce stereotyping and prejudice. One effective strategy with respect to stereotypes in particular is to expose oneself to counter-stereotypic exemplars. So, for example, there's a study where they have people think about Martin Luther King. Well, this was before the controversy surrounding Bill Cosby, but Bill Cosby. And thinking about those positive black exemplars reduced these non-conscious biases relative to
just thinking about it.
Right. Just thinking about them, being exposed to them.
How about being exposed to actual people, Jack?
Well, actually, that's probably one of the most potent methods. And there's a very simple and elegant theory in psychology called the contact hypothesis, which has fortunately been studied very well. And there are hundreds of studies, and they've been meta-analyzed, which means that researchers have taken the hundreds of studies and their results and combined them in meaningful ways and found that, generally speaking, when you put people into interpersonal contact with members of other groups, and that can be across racial lines or age lines or sexual orientation or political ideology, pretty much across any kind of different group lines, if you put people into mere non-negative contact, so they're interacting with each other in not a competitive or hostile sort of way, their attitudes toward the entire other group that the other person represents tend to improve. And that's, that's a strong argument in favor of desegregation. And it's a strong argument in policing in favor of diversification of police forces and community-oriented policing so that police can be in minority communities having non-negative interactions with people where they're just talking to people and getting to know them. And that will improve that. The challenge with changing stereotypes, per se, the content of the actual stereotypes, the associations we have between groups and traits, is that even if we can create situations where we can think of positive exemplars, and of course, President Obama is a chronically salient positive exemplar, the rest of the environment that we're in or that we go back into is saturated with the other exemplars. And so it's a tall order to try to have any lasting change to stereotypes without having lasting structural changes to the way in which we interact with other people.
Let me read an email from Kathy. She says, when I attend an event with a black friend where the audience is white, I find myself wondering how she feels to be the only black person present. I also find if I'm not distracted when with her, I think about the fact that I'm with a black person and I feel positive about it. And this makes me question my prejudices. I like the person who says that my best friend is black. I'd like to think I'm open to all races, but is there something in the background that makes we question this, a kind of self-consciousness, I think, that Kathy is talking about. Can you speak to that, Stacey?
Yes. It's an interesting dilemma because we're talking about these subtle non-conscious biases. And so at the same time that people may have these subtle non-conscious biases, they very well consciously could be completely egalitarian. And so what happens is that in the situations where the norms are clear, the people who are egalitarian can kind of override these initial impulses and behave in an egalitarian way. But when the situation is less clear or when they're not paying enough attention or when they're tired, the unconscious biases can potentially leak out. And so the person who sent the email, chances are that person is egalitarian and chances are that person is also biased to some extent. And it's a constant struggle to try and navigate those dual impulses.
Yeah, the kind of self-consciousness, Jack, that I think Kathy was writing about. But I think many people have felt that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to out myself. I'm somebody with strong egalitarian, conscious egalitarian views who occasionally, you know, feels the tug of a racially prejudiced feeling when I encounter somebody from another racial or ethnic group. And Jesse Jackson has outed himself in the same way. He very famously said that, you know, it's a terrible point in his life when he realized that as walking down a city street at night, and hearing footsteps behind him, he was relieved to find out it was a white person. And this is something that we're, you know, again, our environment is saturated with these stereotypes, so it's pretty hard to just shut them off. I want to make one comment here because I know our primary goal is to talk about police, or, you know, the issue with policing and lethal force and policing. And one of the real big challenges that we face is that policing is an activity that tends to operate under a fairly high level of uncertainty. And as Stacey mentioned, when people are doing things quickly or when they're under time pressure, that's when stereotypes are more likely to influence their behavior. And these shooting situations are exactly that. Not only is there time pressure and high degrees of uncertainty, but there's fear and anxiety. And so it's a situation that's ripe for stereotype-based judgments, and I think that's largely why we're seeing these racial disparities in who is the subject of lethal force, even among people who are unarmed and not posing a threat.
Let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Jack Glazer, Associate Professor, Associate Dean at the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley, author of Suspect Race, Causes and Consequences of Racial Profiling. Also with us, Stacey Sinclair, Associate Professor of Psychology and African American Studies at Princeton University. And she has, both of our guests have actually studied things like unconscious bias and prejudice and stereotyping. 1-888-477-9499. Call us. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Stacey Sinclair and Jack Glazer about racism and racial profiling and stereotypes and explosion of phone calls here. And I do want to get to our callers. But Stacey, I want to have you describe for our listeners some interesting research that you've done. It involves people wearing T-shirts.
So as Jack had mentioned, a very powerful way of reducing stereotyping and prejudice is intergroup contact. So exposing, for example, whites to African-Americans over time will reduce their biases against African-Americans. In my research, I'm particularly interested in ways whites can help other whites reduce their biases. I think it's actually a little bit unfair to make the targets of stereotyping and prejudice responsible for the reduction of stereotyping and prejudice. And so one of the ways we look at whites helping other whites is through this T-shirt paradigm. So we have participants come into the lab. They interact with an experimenter. The experimenter is either nice or mean. Mean on a college campus is having a bowl of candy and taking the candy away.
That's the university definition of mean?
Yes.
Okay, fair enough.
It's very hard to get the students who run this to do that. And the experiments are also wearing a blank shirt or a shirt that says e-racism, a shirt that connotes being against racism. And what we find just simply interacting with a nice experimenter wearing an anti-racism shirt reduces participants' implicit bias. So even on that measure with the sunflowers that I talked about, where the participants have no idea that we've then sat them down at a computer and are measuring their prejudice, it goes down around that person. And so our argument is that when people want to get along with someone who has clearly egalitarian views, they just are more egalitarian. We adapt to our interpersonal context. And so one way people can reduce prejudice is by wearing their egalitarian views on their sleeve and being nice about it. And you can change the prejudice of the people around you, who then can change the prejudice of the people around them.
Makes sense to you, Jack?
It does. And somewhat inspired by that research, my lab has conducted some studies that show that there are some people who appear to be what we call high in implicit motivation to control prejudice. And these folks, the way that we measure that is we look to see how strongly negative their attitude toward prejudice is on an implicit measure. And we find that they seem to be able to control their responses on what's called the shooter task, which is an actual simulation of police behavior where people are asked to shoot, you know, through a computer simulation, shoot somebody who's armed and not shoot somebody who's unarmed, and we vary whether that target person is black or white. The general tendency is that most people who do these experiments, including police officers who have been run through these experiments, are faster to shoot the armed blacks than the armed whites, and also are more likely to make the error of shooting unarmed blacks than unarmed whites. But our high implicit motivation to control prejudice people seem to be able to reduce that to some extent, in spite of showing that they actually do have the stereotype linking blacks with weapons. They nevertheless, in their more behavioral response, show some control. So there is some hope for people controlling this, but we give them fairly optimal conditions. Again, if they were out there in the field and they're actually being, you know, if they believe that their life is in danger, that's another matter entirely.
And just a quick question, does that change if the police officer is black?
It's a little more mixed for African-American officers, and what we find across a lot of different studies is that while whites will, you know, about 80 or so percent of whites will exhibit pro-white, anti-black bias, blacks will be sort of more split down the middle. And this actually goes all the way back to the famous Clark and Clark baby doll study that was cited in the Brown versus Board of Education case, where black children were given, you know, the option of choosing either a dark or a light-colored doll. And the white kids all wanted the white doll, but the black kids were sort of more ambivalent about it. And that's something that shows up in the implicit attitude measures as well, and it shows up, as far as I understand it, in the shooting behavior as well. But there are, you know, it can be pushed around. So there are circumstances under which black officers will be more likely to shoot white suspects. There are circumstances under which they'll be more likely to shoot black suspects.
Let me get to Bruce from Malvern to join our conversation. And Bruce, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi.
I don't think anyone has gotten to the essence of what causes bigotry. Bigotry is an unconscious defense mechanism against low self-esteem. And people project their own negative traits onto the targets of their bigotry. So, for example, with Adolf Hitler, who regarded Jews as a race, Hitler maintained that he wasn't unscrupulous himself. The Jews were the ones who broke the rules as long as they ceased to be to their advantage. He wasn't a tyrant. The Jews were the tyrant. He wasn't devoid of virtue. The Jews were the scoundrels who reveled in the shameless promotion of vice.
Well, Bruce,
he didn't eventually succeed in starting the Second World War. The Jews did.
Yeah, let me take your point, because I don't want to get too off track, but I think it's an interesting one. And actually, I want to put it to Stacey, whether when you look at the sort of drill down on the sort of psychology of racism, whether you find things like fear and insecurity and the kinds of things that Bruce was talking about.
So there is some research showing a relationship between self-esteem and out-group in-group favoritism. So people who are lower in self-esteem, for example, will show more bias toward in-group members and away from out-group members. But I think the central understanding of prejudice and stereotyping is more along the lines of what Jack and I have been discussing, which is categorization. The same psychological processes that allow us to know a chair and categorize something in the shape of a chair as a chair when we see it, those same processes encourage us to categorize different kinds of people. And as a function of that basic process, then we map on these stereotypes that are pervasive in society and corresponding feelings, which would be prejudice.
Jack, are whites more prejudice or do more stereotyping than minorities?
No, I wouldn't say that. Again, you know, it's fairly normal to prefer your own group. The difference is that because we live in a society, and this has been true of, you know, virtually every society ever, we live in a hierarchical society where some groups have more privilege and status than others, and that tends to map on fairly well to race and ethnicity. Because we're in that structure, there's going to be the case that the group with the higher status is going to have an easier time liking their own group than groups with lower status who, in addition, you know, in conflict with one's preference to like people like you, you also have to deal with the notion that your people like you have lower status and you encounter those same stereotypes that try to explain the lower status. So it, you know, the normal cognitive processes that give rise to stereotyping and prejudice are present for everybody across all racial and ethnic groups and genders, but the way that interacts with the sociocultural environment we're in is going to be different. Mm. And there's fascinating research showing that people from lower status, lower power groups are going to generate stereotypes as well that are going to help to explain why their group has lower status, because that's in some ways, you know, easier to accept than that they just are not getting a fair shake.
Let me see what Pat from Chester Springs has to say. And Pat, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi
there.
I wondered if anybody had studied black-owned businesses to see if they prefer their own racial group to hire in the way that you're describing that it happens in the white community. Mm-hmm. And to the police issue, is it that black people distrust white policemen only, or is it that they distrust all policemen? I mean, the two policemen killed in New York, one was Hispanic and one was Asian. So is it, I get the idea that it's all police. Thank you.
Pat, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Looking at the business applications, have people looked whether the business owner was African-American or whether they were white? I mean, in terms of sort of how deep this research goes, Stacey?
God, that is a really good question. Yeah. So in my understanding of the audit studies is that they haven't looked at that particular factor. Given the research that Jack and I have been talking about, I would imagine a more ambivalent response on the part of African-American mm-hmm. business owners. So on one hand, we live in a hierarchical society. African-Americans are exposed to stereotypes, negative stereotypes of African Americans, but there also is the countervailing, you know, preference for your own group. And so I would imagine my prediction would be that they may show some degree of in-group bias, but it would be much less than a corresponding white business owner. But as far as I know, there isn't specifically research on that.
Jack, anything you want to say in response to Pat's call?
No, I agree. That's a great question. And on the policing side, it's again going to be this more ambivalent situation. You're right to bring up the shooting in New York. Those were both minority officers, mm-hmm. And that does seem to have that does seem to have had some racial motivations behind it. So there's it's really hard to say anything definitive about that, except to say that police officers are perceived as representing the power structure, and to that extent, they're going to be painted with the same brush.
We have an email from Ali. I come from a mixed-race home. My mother is West African and my dad is white Caucasian. I didn't realize until I was in school that I was different. I didn't know that I was a different color until someone told me that I was, that I was supposed to act a certain way because of my skin color. My parents taught me just to be me. I wonder if parents are the catalyst for all this, as she says, or Ali says, all this hate. You were talking, Stacey, about children being, by the age of 4, sort of begin to categorize people. Interesting, someone from a mixed race background, perhaps a different kind of experience growing up.
Right. The basic understanding of the basis of implicit bias is exposure to societal norms and information. So there is some research linking parental attitudes to children's attitudes, but that surprisingly is pretty mixed.
Really? Interesting.
It depends on a variety of factors, and it's just never been a particularly clean finding, in my opinion. Well, I'm more persuaded by research suggesting that the stereotypes and other biased exposure to in-groups and out-groups in children's media, subsequently in adult television, those things have a stronger hand in shaping our biases. And it made me think of a story.
Sure.
So I actually have a 4-year-old son, and I study prejudice. I, you know, definitely think that African Americans are okay. And he is obsessed by superheroes. He watches, well, actually, he doesn't watch superhero shows, but I think his friends must play superheroes.
Yeah. And he loves superheroes.
Yeah, I don't know how he got into the superheroes. But the moral of the story is he once told me that he can't be a superhero because he's brown.
Wow.
And, you know, he learned this from his friends who watch these shows who've never seen a brown superhero. And we had a long conversation about how he's super to me, and superheroes can be brown. And even if you don't know of one, it's still a possibility. But at least in that particular instance, right, my research, my views were irrelevant to his understanding of possibilities. And what was relevant was the larger popular media.
His peers telling them this. We only have a couple of minutes before we have to go. And Jack, if I can go back to you, and I'm sort of segueing between the kind of research that Stacey has been doing and what you've been doing with police. And we recently had the police commissioner of Philadelphia on, and he's the man that Obama tapped to take a look at 21st century policing, part of that having to do with things like racial profiling and looking at the relationship between police and the communities that they serve. And based on your research in about a minute or so, what advice would you have for this task force on 21st century policing?
Well, boy.
Sorry about
that's
that.
That's a tough one. No, that's okay. I've given this a lot of thought, and there are no – let me say right off the bat that we are not ready to recommend any particular kinds of training programs to reduce bias in policing. That seems like an obvious fix, but there are no training programs that have been demonstrated to work. There are training programs that have been used and that even the officers who go through them like, but in terms of their impact on actual performance, we just don't know. And there's some indication that some of them, there's some positive indication that they don't work, and even some indication that sometimes they have counterproductive effects. So on the training front, there's a lot of work to be done there. We need to collect better data so that we can track what's going on, and there's good effort and good progress moving in that direction. And for me, the low-hanging fruit is to try to identify and constrain where possible the discretion that officers have when they're making judgments about who to investigate. And you can look to the data, and especially the data coming out of New York, which is useful because there's a lot of it and it's fairly reliable, although not perfectly. There's a lot of data indicating that the vast majority of stops in the stop and frisk program are unproductive. Huh. So really about 94-95% of them yield no contraband or anything like that. So we know from that police are operating this high discretion, high uncertainty environment, and they're making judgments based on low information. And when you do that, and under the time pressures and the exigencies of the job, that's when the stereotyping is going to be most influential.
And so I got to stop you there. I'm so sorry to do that to you, Jack Glaser. I appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times. Thanks so much. And Stacey Sinclair, thank you very much for joining us. A little inelegant close to the show, but they're playing my song. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about the program. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of the show. It's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.